Folks, I'm told by some of my colleagues that you can't unite the country, that Biden, on one side, they make, well, Biden's kind of been around too long. The other side is Biden's naive. Well, I don't know. I've been around a long time. You'd think being around a long time, you'd learn a little something, you know? And the thing I've learned is that the American people, after three years already of this guy, have decided that a lot of what he's talking about is hokum.
Former Vice President Joe Biden at the Iowa State Fair this week, addressing critics, taking on President Trump, firing up the crowd. The annual event is known as the unofficial start to campaign season. Nearly all of the 2020 candidates are in Des Moines, feasting on all sorts of fried food and fraternizing with potential voters, even though the Hawkeye State's caucuses are still several months away. That's because the fair has long been seen as a rite of passage of presidential wannabes. But with campaigns starting earlier and national media driving more of the conversation, how much does that still ring true? Holly Bailey is in Des Moines covering this for The Washington Post and joins us now from the Iowa State Fair. And welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So you are at the fair now, we can hear, and almost all of the candidates are there as well, except for Beto O'Rourke. He's staying in El Paso in the wake of this week's shooting. So what's going on right now there, state fair-wise, and what are the candidates doing or eating or saying?
Well, Marianne Williamson just wrapped up her speech at the, what happens is that they all come and speak at what is called the Soapbox, which is sponsored by the Des Moines Register, the largest newspaper in the state. They get about 20 minutes to give a stump speech, and then they take some questions. And so Marianne Williamson just wrapped up her remarks today, and Tulsi Gabbard is coming up next. Tomorrow is like probably the biggest day because we're going to hear from many of the leading contenders, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and it's literally going to be back to back to back to back. So it's going to be a test for the candidates. It's going to be a test for the people who stand out in this blazing hot sun. You know, you just sort of test how long that their stamina and sort of standing through all of this. And also, it's a good idea. You know, it'll be a, give us a good glimpse at sort of ground operations. You can see how many people these candidates get out to hold signs for them and to sign up names for their lists and that sort of thing.
And Biden does have a fraught relationship with Iowa, right? In 1987, he was accused of plagiarism in his state fair speech.
Yeah.
And just yesterday, he said poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids. Wow.
Yeah.
Did you catch that speech?
He actually made that remark after he left the fair. He had done a campaign event last night here in Des Moines. But yeah, it is just sort of a reminder of, it's not even just the fair. It's just these, you know, these events here in Iowa where you can sort of start speak casually and, you know, in some cases, you know, sort of speak off the cuff and say things like that, and it becomes a huge thing. You know, and he's not the first person to sort of step in it at the fair. I mean, Mitt Romney is maybe at least the most famous recently because he, you know, when throughout the 2012 campaign, he was haunted by this statement he made saying corporations are people. And that happened here at the fair. And his campaign actually thought that that was a good thing to say. And they did not realize at the time how much that would go on to define his campaign. So his candidates really have to be very, very careful. And it's hard because you kind of come in this environment and it's kind of casual and it's actually kind of funny. You joke about the fair food you eat and you sort of walk around and it's this joyful atmosphere, but you're being watched very, very closely. And sometimes people just kind of lose it a little bit.
Right. And they're visual gaffes. I mean, I remember, wasn't it John Kerry back in 2003? He was seen with a strawberry smoothie and an umbrella coming out of it. And then that he had that reputation for being too snooty.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, you know, and the people try to every year try to, you know, they pressure the candidates to eat a corn dog, but eating a corn dog and not looking awkward is very, very tricky. And in fact, earlier this morning, Andrew Yang, who is, you know, one of the sort of the people at the bottom of the polls, made his rounds around the fair, surrounded by tons of media and curious people, and was trying to eat a turkey leg, a gigantic turkey leg, in a way that was like, you know, that didn't make him seem, you know, awkward on camera. And but he finally just gave in, and he told us, you know, I've been to 1,000 Renaissance fairs and I love this. So he was, you know, making a joke about it. So
well, the big question really is, does making an appearance though at the state fair matter anymore? Because voters, they have plenty of opportunities now, what with social media, to get a look at candidates in less scripted moments, right? Does anyone care whether, you know, Kamala Harris eats a fried Twinkie or poses with a 200-pound pig in Iowa anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does make a difference. I mean, there's one thing of looking at somebody sort of being, you know, Elizabeth Warren, you know, sipping beer on her Instagram stories is not the same as seeing Elizabeth Warren sipping a beer 20 feet away from you. And half the time, you know, there's a tricky thing, a dynamic here about the fair is that it's become such a media event that half the time these candidates are just surrounded by just huge scrum of reporters and cameras, and half the time voters can't really get a good glimpse, but they stand, you know, back and they'll tap us on the shoulder and say, who is that person? And when they learn, they go, oh my God, they get their phone out and they run up and also and try to get a selfie, which is a significant thing. And, you know, somebody here explained it to me just saying, you know, it's seeing someone walk by 10 feet away from you is important. They think, you know, that it's a sign of somebody really trying to invest in Iowa. And of course, you know, it's not just, you can't just come to the fair and think you're going to do well in Iowa. It's, you have to be in their living room and at their, you know, their libraries and doing public events. And so they sort of weigh it in that way.
Well, that is really the flip side of that question, though, whether how much a candidate's fate in Iowa is tied to this appearance at the state fair versus their ability to meet the national donor and polling thresholds to get on the debate stage.
Yeah.
And just get the name out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, you know, Marianne Williamson just now in her speech, she's one of the people who is still yet to qualify for the polls, and she just made this huge appeal because, one, half of these speeches are being live-streamed, and so people that aren't even here are watching, you know, and she just basically made this pitch, you know, if you care at all, you don't even have to caucus for me, but if you just give me a dollar, you know, and help me continue to get, you know, my message out, this is important. And she was arguing, tell everybody you know, and looking at the cameras and making that appeal, and so, you know, it is interesting. I mean, we're running up on this dynamic where a lot of these people that are in the race, these people that are polling at 1%, 2% or less, you know, are going to have a real struggle to qualify for, you know, the September poll, the September debate, the October debate. They are running into quite a dilemma there.
And we'll be checking in with you. Thank you, though, for this.
Yeah, thank you.
Eat something fried for me. Holly Bailey, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up, here's a quiz. What's more deadly than any other single factor in history? Having killed nearly half of all the human beings who have ever lived. Answer, the great destroyer of worlds goes by the name of mosquito. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Destroyer of Worlds, the Apex Predator. It sounds like a new Marvel movie subtitle, doesn't it? But no, this is how author Timothy Weingard describes a common global pest in his new book, The Mosquito. He argues that mosquitoes have been the deciding factor in countless wars and that they've killed more people than any other single cause in history. Some 52 billion of us, more than half of all humans who've ever lived, fundamentally shaping the path of human civilization. And now, as the planet warms, mosquito-borne diseases like malaria, dengue fever, and Zika may spread to new areas of the globe, wreaking new kinds of havoc in the process. Timothy Weingard joins me now. I took a big breath because I kind of scared myself in that last paragraph. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you just make it sound like mosquitoes are kind of the Terminator Zelig of history. They just show up everywhere, that they've decided more wars and extinctions than any other deadly weapon or force, starting back with the dinosaurs. So let's start there. What evidence is there that mosquitoes doomed the dinosaurs and not those asteroids?
Well, the disease theory of dinosaur endangerment or extinction of regional or certain species doesn't supplant or supersede the meteor theory. There's ample evidence across the academic fields to support the meteor collapse theory when the meteor hit roughly 65 million years ago near the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. But prior to that, the new theories are saying that certain dinosaurs or dinosaur species or regionally were either endangered or extinct from vector-borne diseases from mosquitoes and sandflies and ticks. So she played a part, and I say she because only females bite. It's theorized that she played a part in reducing dinosaur populations prior to the meteor, and the meteor was the knockout punch, if you will.
And make the case also for us, or the link between mosquitoes and Christianity.
Well, I would never be so reckless, and I don't say this in the book, that the mosquito, or malaria more specific, the mosquito is harmless. It's the diseases that she transmits. Is the single factor in the spread of rise and spread of Christianity, but it certainly plays a part. The Pontine Marshes surrounding Rome were a hotbed of endemic and epidemic malaria throughout antiquity. So early Christians viewed healing and care to the sick as a duty of faith. So they actually opened the first true hospitals. So because malaria was so endemic and pervasive around Rome and in Italy, it was viewed as a remedial religion for a lot of converts.
And the American Revolution? I'm thinking my eye was caught by what a punny chapter title of yours, Unalienable Bites, the American Revolution. How do mosquitoes figure into the American fight for independence?
Well, in the final few years of the war, the British shift their grand strategy from a northern campaign to a southern campaign. And General Cornwallis, the British commander, his troops are zigzagging across the Carolinas. And in his own correspondence, he says he's running away essentially from malarial fevers. And he's ordered to hole up in Yorktown against his better judgment. And while in Yorktown, in his own correspondence, he says that after the Americans and French lay siege, that the surrender is mostly caused by the fact that he has 35 to 37% of his troops left standing, with the vast majority dead, dying, or incapable of fighting because of malarial infection. So in a way, the mosquito is a founding mother of the United States.
Well, you argue that many more lives are lost due to mosquitoes than in actual battles. So why are mosquitoes so effective or influential, particularly in wars?
Well, one, because they spread a catalog of disease, not just malaria, but yellow fever prior to the vaccine in the 1930s was a paramount killer, especially in the colonial tropics of the Americas. So what happens is you're bringing non-immune or troops from other places in the world who haven't been what they call seasoned to these diseases in the locations they're fighting. So what you're getting is these troops coming and moving, and one side usually benefits from the sickness or death rate of the other side.
And generals understood this and used mosquitoes as weapons, or at least used them in their strategy, right?
Well, we didn't know it was the mosquito until the late 1800s, early 1900s, depending on which disease we're talking about, that the mosquito was actually the vector or transporter of these diseases. It was viewed that most diseases were caused by the miasma theory, basically that noxious and deadly particles emanated from stagnant swamps and standing water and marshes. So they were tantalizingly close to fingering the actual mosquito that lived and bred in these marshes. So we see throughout people using, in a way, the marshes as a weapon, but not necessarily the actual mosquitoes themselves.
Hey, switching gears for a moment. It is summer. Can we do some mosquito myth busting? Do some people tend to get bitten more than others?
She seems to prefer, research says she prefers blood type O over A, B in their blend. Unfortunately, roughly 85% of what makes a person attractive or less attractive to mosquitoes is pre-hardwired in their genetic circuit board, and that includes chemical and bacterial levels in and on the skin, including lactic acid, the natural emissions of carbon dioxide coming from an individual person, the bacteria on our feet are a mosquito aphrodisiac. So they like stinky feet.
They do.
The bacteria on our feet are a big attraction. So, you know, wash your feet, I suppose. But at the same time, certain perfumes and applied fragrances also attract mosquitoes. So at the end of the day, she does prefer some over others. But we've all doused ourselves in bug spray. And if we miss one spot, she seems to find that chink in our armor, or our Achilles heel, if you will.
And continuing with the myth busting, or confirming, there's such a thing as mosquito swarms that can kill a human in less than 2 hours. True or false?
Well, that is true. In the Arctic, mosquitoes can bleed young caribou to death at a bite rate of 9,000 bites per minute. So if you extrapolate that to a human, it would drain half the human blood in roughly 2 hours.
Whoa. Well, wait. There are some fun things too that we can attribute to mosquitoes. Gin and tonics?
The gin and tonic, yes. The first successful anti-malarial that we know of was something called quinine, which you still see on the labels of, you know, Canada Dry tonic water, contains quinine. So the Brits in India obviously had endemic malaria. So during colonial times, the British needed to take their powdered quinine, and so they mixed it with tonic water, you know, to dissolve the powder, and then added gin to cut the bitter taste of the quinine. And I'm also guessing certainly for its intoxicating effect, and the gin and tonic was born.
Well, scientists, I know, are not trying to get rid of mosquitoes, but they are trying to make them less harmful.
The idea specifically with this mind-boggling CRISPR gene editing technology that was unveiled in 2012 is there's two avenues, is to CRISPR mosquitoes, releasing them into the wild of a specific species, thereby making their offspring infertile, stillborn, or only male, which could potentially eradicate that specific species. But more to the point is being able to CRISPR mosquitoes with a gene drive or a selfish gene that would be passed down their hereditary bloodline to simply make that species harmless by making it those mosquitoes incapable of actually vectoring the disease itself, thereby bringing down the disease, but not that mosquito species.
Well, I mentioned global warming in my introduction. What impact are we seeing with respect to mosquitoes and the diseases they spread?
Well, mosquitoes are cold-blooded, so they're obviously temperature-dependent, and their life cycle and reproductive cycle is dependent on the outside temperature. What we're seeing annually is a decrease in malaria rates, which is certainly a good thing because malaria is the paramount killer. But on the other hand, what we're seeing is the emergence or reemergence of other mosquito-borne diseases that aren't as prolific killers as malaria. But for example, I read a bunch of articles that said 4 billion people on the planet are at risk of dengue fever alone. So we're seeing the spread of dengue and into other places where it hasn't been or hasn't been for quite a while. Zika, obviously, West Nile, chikungunya. So some of these other mosquito-borne diseases are emerging or re-emerging on that hand, whereas the malaria rates are being cut on the other hand.
So in researching all of this, did anything just leap out at you, something you didn't know that really surprised you?
Well, there's two very quick ones. Summoning cures for malaria. Herodotus tells us that the ancient Egyptian practice was to bathe in fresh human urine. Now, thankfully, we don't have to do that anymore. And one of the Roman remedies was to wear an amulet or a papyrus around their neck with the magic word, abracadabra, essentially summoning a cure for malaria.
I didn't know that. Thank you for that. And thank you for talking today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Tim Weingard, he's the author of a new book called The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator. Journalist Adam Popescu has covered Everest for the BBC. Now he's written a novel set in the Himalayas.
You're in a place where life and death are so intertwined, where you're walking past glaciers, that if you do take a wrong step or do forget where you are, you can die.
A coming-of-age story about a young Sherpa called Nima. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave. Climbing Mount Everest, the world's highest peak at over 29,000 feet, was once reserved for ultra-elite mountaineers. But expeditions have become less expensive and more accessible to novice climbers, and that means dangerous overcrowding on the mountain. This spring, images of a traffic jam of hundreds of climbers trying to reach the top went viral. That season, 11 people died trying to summit. Sherpas, the local guides who help Westerners reach the top, carrying their heavy loads, pay a high price for the Western exploitation of Everest, sometimes with their lives, and in many other ways, too. Journalist Adam Popescu has visited the Himalayas several times, reporting on Everest for the BBC, and now he's written a novel. It's about a young woman Sherpa. It's called Nima. And Adam, it's good to have you on Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Nima's your protagonist, but she also is called Eldest.
Right.
And is she based on anyone in particular that you've come across during your time in the Himalayas?
So Nima is a very universal character, even though she is extremely localized. And when I say that, the issues that this book deals with, which are climate, which are opportunity and education, which are, you know, coming of age, are something that I think is very relatable. I wanted to put it in a place that both spoke to me in a very evocative, very magical way, and yet I also felt an extreme connection in a strange way to these mountains. I had, as you mentioned, I had been there as a journalist, first for the BBC in 2013, and I knew nothing about this culture, and I was a very amateur mountaineer. I learned a lot of stuff on the fly, and I overcompensated, and I had overconfidence in general, which can be dangerous, and that's why we've seen so many deaths, you know, of late, because people think that they can do it when they see something on Instagram. You see a beautiful photo, you see an idealized romantic portrait, and the more time I spent in these mountains, the last 2 years I've been back, and I spent over two months in the last 2 years in the Himalayas, really blossoming that interest. But to take it back to who Nima is, and the reason I wrote this book is that there are so many important things in this book that I couldn't cover as a journalist.
Well, yeah, and you really capture this culture and the feeling of it, and this with real specificity, and it's very granular how you write about what it would be like to grow up there. And I'm thinking the story begins with Nima's account of an avalanche
right. That
injures her father badly, and you do describe it beautifully. You say there's a Sherpa saying that there are as many kinds of roo, and roo is an avalanche, as there are people wet and filled with sloughs and slabs or glides when the entire snowpack moves on as one, or slush like a flash flooding of permafrost. It made me wonder, how do Sherpas talk about avalanche? Or is it something that, you know, looms large in a conversation, or is it more of a taboo since it's so
really
devastating?
It really actually is a taboo. You know, when you're in a place where life and death are so intertwined, where you're walking past glaciers, that if you do take a wrong step or do, in a way, forget where you are, you can die. And it sounds dramatized and overly so, but it's very true. So your relationship to everything is very in the moment. And if something bad does happen, you have to cry and you have to move on. And for the people in the West, that may sound to be cold, but the reality of living in a place where you're wed to the seasons and wed to the earth, you have to really respect that. So people don't talk about avalanches, because if you talk about an avalanche, it's like you're incurring that spirit.
And right, you're calling it forth.
You're calling it forth, and you're talking about something that is the biggest fear. And there's a reason that within the Sherpa community and within Nepalese, they're saying that there has been so much tragedy the last few years is because the mountain has been overexploited, and the mountain has been turned into something that it's not supposed to be. This is a holy place. And because there's so many people coming, it's hard to say no when you're living on less than a dollar a day. So there's this whole give and take here of how do you preserve a place and keep it beautiful and natural, and how do you live in this modern world?
And you also pick up and carry this theme of what it's like to be a woman in this culture. And I really had no idea. I mean, your protagonist says that girls are bad luck on the mountain. So how ingrained is that kind of sexism in Sherpa culture?
I think it's ingrained big time, and I think it's ingrained in so many cultures. If you think of from an agriculture pastoralist standpoint, the reason we want boys is not because we prefer a boy so much as we need someone to work in the fields. We need someone to carry stuff. We need someone to do all that heavy labor. And because a lot of jobs are not open to women.
Nima's family in your book falls on hard times because of the father's injury. He's the breadwinner. He is the guide who he leads guiding trips up the mountain. It's the only thing he can do, knows how to do. And you write that trekking work is the only way to make real money in the Himalayas. So is that the case? If you don't have a family member who guides climbers on Everest, then you basically are doomed to poverty.
I think that's a bit extreme. I think you could have a tea house where you're basically, it's a lodging for foreigners. Something even so small as a tea stand. That's a good way to make money because there are people coming. But you need capital to do that. And this mountain, the Everest region, it's very inundated by tourists, but there's a whole, this is a large, large area of the Himalayas, and not everyone is so economically developed. Infrastructure is lacking. So there is certainly haves and have-nots.
So how do the Sherpa think of all of these climbers coming to Everest? And you get into this a little bit, or a lot, in the novel, and you kind of set up this dichotomy that on one hand, they're dependent on the tourists for their livelihoods, since so much of their livelihood and their resources have vanished or become protected. But on the other hand, the tourists are a scourge environmentally, spiritually.
Yeah, I think that this you put it perfectly. You know, these people, they rely on this virus in a way.
Do they talk about it that way? Because they do in your book.
They do in my book. People have very good manners. So they would never be so freely talking about it. Once you make a friendship, people might open up a bit. But what are you supposed to do? I mean, this is something that we can take to so many locales that are in danger of losing a culture. At what point is a culture assimilated into the monoculture? If it's just being performed for a group of tourists when they stop in the port, or is it something that people normally do in their regular life? I mean, it's a hard thing, and that's something else that I found very fascinating as a reporter and as a person to watch.
Well, it is really complex because the Sherpa built the support system, that roped trail up to the summit that has really lowered the bar for climbing Everest, and that's what's drawn even less prepared climbers to the mountain, all of this support, and they provide the support that allows less prepared climbers to climb. So in a way, they share the responsibility for the situation now on this overcrowded, littered, dangerous mountain.
I think it's easy for us here to say from the relative comfort of our lives and homes here that this is wrong or this is not right or there's a paradox here. But once you're in these places, I think that the lines get blurred and the black and whites disappear.
Right, because it's so close to the bone to make a living, you're saying.
And when you're left with very little choices, it's easy to rationalize, but it's also easy for someone to say that that's the wrong choice.
Well, what is it like on the mountain now? I mean, is the trail to base camp literally thick with dust because of so many climbers, as the way you describe it in the book?
So it is full of dust and it is dirty, but it's not a heap of trash.
Which you hear a lot.
You hear a lot.
You just see littered, the snow is covered near the summit with trash, with the remnants of what climbers have left behind, even with, dead bodies.
It's true. There's also seasons. There's a very limited window for the climbing season, and that's when the masses come. You mentioned the picture that went viral by a fellow who is traveling all the major summits in a, I believe, a 7 or 12 month window, which is very crazy to do. And he's doing it. It's former Special Forces guy. There was a photo taken a week before that photo of the traffic jam where nobody's on the mountain. And that photo didn't get any play worldwide because we had already seen and established this narrative of traffic and whatnot. So again, it's so strange. When I went in December, and there wasn't that many people because it was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people go when it's a little bit easier. And when I got to base camp, it was piles of rocks and ice. And we had to go through the Khumbu Glacier. And there were moments where, you know, you are barely picking your feet up. You're at 16, 17, 18,000 feet, where every breath is half as much oxygen as you feel now. So you are out of it, and it feels lunar, and it is weird. It's so quiet because there's no life up there.
Hmm.
I talk about it with a lot of reverence. And when I'm here in L.A., I think about the mountains. When I'm in the mountains, I think about L.A. because that's the strange paradox of traveling and going to these places. You romanticize the good parts, but when you're there, you think to yourself, wait a second, I miss my good food and heating and everything, all the creature comforts. And it's a weird thing.
Although you don't have to miss Starbucks, right? There's Starbucks pretty...
You know what they have? They have a fake Starbucks up there. They have a fake McDonald's.
You call it a Yak Donald's.
They have a place called Yak Donald's. I'm not kidding. It's really
in the book.
It's really out there.
It's really there. Yak Donald's. But it's not yak meat. Or is it?
It is yak meat.
Okay, so all the burgers are yak.
That's right, because you can't find cows up there.
Well, that's just brilliant branding.
until Mr. McDonald's comes over there.
Well, where's the government of Nepal on this? Where does it stand right now on the situation on Everest? And I should say the other theme that you bring up is that the Sherpa disproportionately pay for the conditions on the mountain. They are often ones who die.
They are.
Right? And why is that? Just explain that for
Well, us. Because typically they set the ropes. They do all the dirty work before the foreigners come. They make it easier for them to climb. They carry up the oxygen. They make the tents. They do all the backbreaking stuff. And the Nepali government is notoriously corrupt, unfortunately. And this is a backwater country in a lot of ways. It's wedged between China on one side and India. And it is a small, tiny nation that has had to, for many years, had to play one off the other. Everest itself is on the border between Nepal and China. The Chinese side is a whole other thing. They don't let people travel so much because it's in Tibet, which is, as you know, is a separatist region, and they have it's a whole other ball of yarn right there. So Nepal has been known for many years as tourist-friendly, as safe, as having English. A lot of people do speak English. So they played this up. And in other places in the Himalayas, as Kashmir and India, Pakistan, as the tourism there has fizzled, Afghanistan, all these places that were once the hippie trail, as it were, as that sort of dried up, a lot of people went to Nepal. And this government, of course, they can't say no. And people pocket a lot of money.
They do have the choice, though, to regulate the industry more rigorously or limit permits or at least divert more climbers to other mountains on the range.
But it's not so sexy to go to Lhotse or to go to Kunde. No one's heard of it.
Are there other things, though, from your reporting and the years that you've spent in the Himalayas that you would like to see done by the government or by well-meaning activists that would help Sherpas economically, culturally, help them survive?
There's one thing we haven't talked about that is in the book, and that's the importance of water. There's a lot of talk about the Arctic and the Antarctic melting, but there is a store of frozen water in these mountains that when this melts, the glaciers in the Himalayas, and this is an area that about 250 million people live in. It's about either 10 or 12 countries. It's a large belt in Central Asia. That water or that ice is going to melt with it, extreme flooding, and then extreme drought. We have a lot of issues up in a place where many of us are looking. And for locals like Nima, like the Sherpas on Everest, yes, we'll see the death of the climbing culture, but we'll also see the death of this way of life is that will be the real issue. And people will flood to the cities. There'll be issues with jobs, agriculture. That is unfortunately a very big thing that is coming in the next 20, 30 years. It is the big question and the big beyond politics. The big issue of our time is climate. And we have a lot of work to do.
Adam, thanks so much for talking about the book and for the book.
Barbara, thanks for having me.
Adam Popescu, journalist and author of the novel Nima. Warren Olney is here to tell us what's coming up on his To The Point podcast. And Warren, always a delight to see you.
Well, it's a delight to see you too, and nice to have you here. We're going to be talking on our podcast today in the aftermath of the latest mass shootings. We now have 255 people in the country who have been killed in that manner, and we'll be talking about what can we do. There have been various proposals made by Joe Biden, by other Democrats. We have President Trump saying that he doesn't think there's any appetite at the moment for a ban on assault weapons, and he's not really even willing to commit to background checks. So what do we do? And the other aspect of this is, what do we do as journalists? How do we report this stuff? And do we do it without making things worse by disseminating the kind of evil thinking that some of these people who engage in mass shootings are involved in?
All excellent questions, and I know from your shows, your many shows, there'll be excellent answers as well. Thank you for that.
Okay.
And I'll look forward to it, and that's To The Point, the podcast, wherever you get your fine digital audio offerings. And coming up on this show, two new movies featuring star-studded all-female casts and two new beloved children's franchises get the Hollywood treatment. Our Friday film critics are here to fill you in. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, and it's Friday. It's time for film reviews. Hooray. Today, we're joined by Amy Nicholson, film critic for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled. It is great to see you.
Hello. Lovely to see you.
And Tim Grierson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. A happy Friday to you as well.
Happy Friday.
So let's start with After the Wedding. Julianne Moore and Michelle Williams, what a cast. They star in a remake of an Oscar-nominated drama. Here's a taste.
I'm about to donate a small fortune to the orphanage Isabel runs in India.
I don't trust your wife.
She's going to give you money for your charity and you're going to question her integrity, huh?
20 million. What does she want?
Okay, as I understand it, Michelle Williams has an orphanage in India and she comes back to the U.S., where Julianne Moore is a rich benefactor and she's about to cut a huge check for the orphanage. And also we have Billy Crudup in this movie. He's Julianne Moore's hunky husband, but he turns out to have a past with Williams. Awkward.
Correct. That's the entire setup. Basically, Julianne Moore says, come to New York, Michelle Williams, so we can talk about this deal. I am entirely behind your orphanage. I want to write this check. Oh, by the way, my daughter is getting married this weekend. Why don't you stay for the wedding since you're here?
And we'll talk about it after the wedding.
And Michelle Williams feels like, well, I need this money, so I can't say no. And so right. She goes to the wedding and she discovers, oh, Julianne Moore is married to Billy Crudup and they seem to know each other. Why do they know each other? Do they have a dark past?
They know each other so everybody can emote. Right?
Everybody can emote.
Is that right? That's just my impression from the
The music in that trailer tells you how to feel about this movie. It's based on a Suzanne Beer film from 2006, and it is, I liked Suzanne Beer's film, but it was a little soapy and melodramatic. Some of the genders have been switched for this new movie. The problem is it doesn't necessarily understand if it's going to be a really kind of soapy melodrama type of film, or if it's going to be a very serious drama about relationships and regret and reconciling with the past. It's either you choose one or the other. The movie kind of chooses a middle ground. And unfortunately, even though this cast is really good, that doesn't serve the material very well.
Interesting. Okay, well, moving on to The Kitchen. This is another pretty stunning female cast with Melissa McCarthy, Tiffany Haddish, and Elizabeth Moss.
Our husbands have 24 months left on their sentences.
We're going to take care of you.
You girls are gonna be just fine.
We got no money.
Can't even make the rent with what they gave me last night.
They have been telling us forever that we are never gonna do anything but have babies. Bunch of men that have forgotten what family means.
So we remind them.
Patton, hashtag 70s mob movie accents.
Yeah, should we do our review in like Hell's Kitchen accents? I can't do one very
yes,
well. I have to put Amy on the spot.
Is that Hell's Kitchen-y? Sorry, I'm from Texas. I can't fake it.
Hell's yeah. Kitchen as opposed to any other neighborhood in New York.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's based on a DC Vertigo graphic novel. It's set in the late 1970s. These three women are mob wives for, you know, in Hell's Kitchen, and their husbands are arrested. They're sent off to prison for 3 years. The bosses say, don't worry, we're going to take care of you, but they don't. And so these three wives, who are housewives, basically have to take the reins themselves and start running protection rackets in Hell's Kitchen. The mob bosses, who are all men, don't take too kindly to that.
Cool comic, cool concept. So what do you think, Amy?
It's interesting. Watching The Kitchen kind of felt like I went into the movie theater with an extra pair of 3D glasses on, because it's basically two movies at once. On one level, you're watching this straight-up mafia movie, which just proceeds as most mafia movies do. It's a lot of anti-heroes doing a lot of killing. It makes it look cool. You're like, yeah, all right, this is good, Goodfellas-y. You know, the sort of movie that you can go into and not really have to check your conscience at the door, just feel fine with it. But because this movie is cast with women, I think you're looking for heroism in this film that it doesn't have. And so that's what I kept putting these kind of glasses back on my face and wanting more from this movie than it felt like it needed to give.
And it's two very famous, incredibly talented female comedians, too. So I kept expecting something funny.
Yeah, this movie sort of feels like it's at war with each other, just like the characters are at war with all their men in the neighborhood. You know, is this movie pro-violence? Is it anti-violence? Does it support what they're doing? Does it not support what they're doing? And it seems to try to have it every way. It's sort of like machine gun firing on all cylinders. And it's interesting. In a way, I want to stick up for this movie in that, why can't these women just be sociopathic the way every other gangster movie can be sociopathic? But then the movie keeps kind of doubling back and saying, it's okay if that guy got it. He was sexist. And you're like, do I cheer? I don't want to cheer.
Yeah, complicated.
I agree with Amy. I also kind of want to stick up for the movie because I do think the movie, especially as a guy, I think it pushes some interesting buttons where it's like, oh, if the men are doing this type of killing, it's a moral ambiguity, and it's so fascinating because they're wrestling with these demons of good and bad within themselves. And while watching, I thought, oh, well, these are women doing it. I feel differently. And why do I feel differently about that? And I think Andrea Burloff, who wrote and directed this, gets to that a little bit, but then the movie becomes the movie. And I think it kind of like really kind of mishandles the characters and really kind of mishandles the plot as it goes along.
Moving on, Amy, I'm told our next pick was near and dear to your heart as a kid, right? We're talking scary stories to tell in the dark. And let's hear a bit of that.
What's that?
It's your book of scary stories.
Hey, what's going on?
Tommy's missing.
Tommy's name was in the book.
There's no way it's actually connected, right?
Okay, what if what happens in the book is exactly what's happened for real?
Sarah Bellows' book, where the stories write themselves and it all comes alive.
And aptly, this is based on a book series from Alvin Schwartz that you loved.
Yeah, I think if you're a creepy kid who was raised in the 80s or 90s, these books were the touchstones that turned you on to horror. They were famous in my day for being the number one book that parents would try to pull out of libraries because they were so scary and so gruesome. And they had this really fascinating visual style that kind of looked like the Ralph Steadman art, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But done by this terrifying artist named Stephen Gamble, and all ink blots and scratches and severed feet. And
What I remember the spider bite that keeps growing and growing and growing till it takes over someone's
Well, if you like that, that's in this movie. You know, this movie tries to figure out how to be kind of a greatest hits of all the stories that you loved, which were so in the deep of the back of my head that when you see somebody write down the words the toe, I thought, oh, I remember that one. Here we go. But then they have to come up with a framework around it. And so the framework to tell all these stories is that we're in 1968. There's a very strong Vietnam setting, very strong Nixon setting. And these kids go out on Halloween and steal a book that belongs to somebody. And therefore, the stories now exist in their world. I thought the first hour of this movie, to be honest, really had the feeling of a great classic for kids. It really gets that sense of, you're right on the teetering on the edge of being adults. You're a little bit attracted to people now. You have a little bit of freedom. And it has this timeless quality to it that I really, really appreciated until the plot had to kick in further. But this movie has something. I think this movie will turn on a lot of kids to the darkness.
Oh, well, Tim, what do you think? Guillermo del Toro's hand is in this. He's a co-writer.
He's a co-writer. He's a producer. I had not read the books, and so I was actually really curious just to kind of go into it completely fresh. I like, weirdly enough, the second hour better. What I like, and we'll get into this maybe when we talk about Dora a little bit, which is a very different movie in a lot of ways. I actually think this movie does a really good job of being like, Tonka is my first horror movie for kids in a way where
starter horror.
Yeah, because it's not overly gory, but it's creepy and it's unsettling and it's like icky in a really fun way. Like I was actually very disturbed by stuff, but not in a way where I thought, oh, kids can't handle this. I think the movie has the respect of its audience to go, you can handle this.
Well, this kind of thing can live or die by the special effects. How do the monsters come off or the effects?
Well, it's interesting. I'm curious what Amy thinks, because when you read it and you see it on the page, it's one thing. I think there are three really good sequences at the end of this, one after another, that are really affecting and creepy. And I mean, this is relatively low budget, I would say, but it does a really good job of making those creatures. You mentioned the spider bite. That's another thing that is really icky and creepy in this. Yeah, I thought it worked pretty well.
Yeah, I think they do a good job of trying to make those really iconic visual drawings come to life here. I like that a lot.
Well, I like that too. I am intrigued. But we do have to move on to our last film, and it might be a favorite of many people listening, or at least their kids. Dora and the Lost City of Gold. And this is a live-action film version of the popular animated kids show, Dora the Explorer.
We're on to something big, Dora.
An ancient city made of gold. Parapata. And your mother and I are going to prove it.
And me.
I'm sorry, sweetie, you're not going.
What?
Dora, this isn't the jungle. It's high school. It's life or death.
Where did you transfer from?
The jungle.
And it is high school. Dora's almost all grown up, right? She's, what, 15? Something like that?
She's
16?
She's a teenager, yeah. I think, yeah.
And this is live action. Dora is played by Isabella Monet. What is the storyline here? You have to save the parents? What is it?
She goes to stay with her cousin in Los Angeles because she, as the clip indicated, she lives in the jungle with her parents. They go off to find the lost city of gold. She goes to hang out with her cousin in Los Angeles and realizes high school is very different than the jungle, and it's very intimidating in its own way. Her parents go missing. She and her cousin and some other people go to find them, and along the way also find the lost city of gold.
For a moment, I thought you were talking about Mean Girls. But, right?
There, it feels like Mean Girls. I mean, I think that's kind of, for me, the trick with this movie that I was really wrestling with, because I'm not from the Dora generation, but, you know, Dora, if you started liking Dora when she first existed, when she was a 7-year-old cartoon kid, you're now in high school. You might even be in college. And so the idea of aging her up from 7 to 10 to now, I think she's 16.
There's some logic to that, then.
There's some logic in that, but it does take away, I think, from a lot of what makes Dora awesome, that she lives in the jungle with a talking backpack. And the kind of weird surrealness of the cartoon doesn't really work when it's live action and she's messing with people being mean to her at school and where do you sit in the cafeteria, and you're like, oh no, we want more of the weirdo genius Dora. She's irritating to all the people in the movie. They're like, what is her problem? Why is she so happy? And she is the cartoon character that the kids love, but it kind of doesn't fit with all of the pieces they're trying to put together to make this, I think, accessible.
Do they pull off the Latina aspect of Dora? That was a wonderful thing about the cartoon.
It absolutely does. And it's really filled this film with just so many great actors, you know, from Eva Longoria to John Leguizamo to Eugenio Derbez, who is the biggest comedy star in Mexico right now and has been steadily kind of creeping his way in here with films like Overboard. People speak Spanish. There's subtitles in here. There's a lot of respect for Latin America. And so that was lovely to see, even if I was like, this movie is bizarre. What is happening?
It does seem a bit like Uncanny Valley. I mean, just looking at the trailer, it's like a mix, mashup of Indiana Jones and a Nickelodeon after school special.
That's
absolutely
right.
Absolutely, with a touch of Wizard of Oz.
Right, right, right. You don't know where to look.
There is a moment where it does become a cartoon briefly, and in that moment I was like, I want to see this movie. You know, I want to see
on
just
acid.
Like the weird. I wasn't going to say that because I was worried about getting in trouble. I'm so glad you said that because, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
I mean, the characters are on a substance at that point in the movie, so it's not too far afield to suggest that. I mean, for me, like, I did not grow up with Dora, but I had nieces and nephews who watched Dora. And the thing I really liked from afar was that there was an educational quality to it, but it was also like a really fun quality. And I think the problem with the movie is it doesn't know. This is the theme of this week's movies. It doesn't know if it's one or the other. Is it supposed to be kind of comic and making fun of the material, or being more sort of sincere as far as it works? I think Monet is actually really fun because she is Dora, and it's almost kind of like Amy Adams in Enchanted, where she walks into this world and it's like, you don't make any sense in this world, and that's kind of fun, but it's a little too kiddish, and it's like Indiana Jones light or Indiana Jones Jr. almost, and for me it just didn't work.
Okay, well, that'll do it for us for today, but so fun to see both of you. Always a pleasure.
Lovely to see you again.
Good to see you.
Tim Grierson, he's senior U.S. critic for Screen International, and Amy Nicholson, she is film critic for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and Our Film Critics on Press Play. And that's it for us for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Michelle Alloy, Alex Trigfordotter, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, and Devin Schwartz. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Taw is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. And don't forget, all of you, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Barbara Bogave. I hope you have a great weekend, everybody.